You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
There have been a number of conflicting claims as to who or what has caused the current economic catastrophe. According to my next guest, the meltdown wasn't just the fault of complicated schemes like subprime mortgage securitization, but also due to a couple of ideas as old as civilization itself, looting and usury. Joining me now are Thomas Gagin, an author and labor lawyer whose article Infinite Debt is in the April issue of Harper's Magazine, and also with us is New York Times economic scene columnist David Leonhardt. Welcome to our show.
Hi, I'm Tom, and thanks for inviting me.
I'm David. Thanks for having me as well. I feel like saying something they say on sports radio, which is first and long. I'm a first-time guest and long-time listener, so I'm thrilled to be here.
You both make the point that many banks came to have a total disregard for the most basic principles of lending. What are those principles supposed to be? Let's begin with you, David.
Well, I think the real problem here is that banks were not actually thinking about making loans that were economically rational. They were instead thinking about loans that could bring them short-term profits. And they had a great incentive to make those short-term profits, personal incentives. In many cases, they made enormous amounts of money. And either intuitively or consciously, they understood that they wouldn't be left holding the bag when these things went wrong. And I think in some cases they really knew what they were doing, and I think in many cases they didn't. But the fact is that the incentives were there for them to care about the short term and really not to care about the long term.
And they wouldn't be left holding the bag because they knew the government would back them up?
That's right. Or at least.
How long has this been going on, David?
It's been going on for a very long time. I mean, I wrote last week about this wonderful paper written by two economists, George Akerlof.
Who
won the Nobel Prize, and Paul Romer, who many people think may one day win the Nobel Prize. And they wrote this paper back in the early 90s called Looting. And they looked at the S&L crisis in the 80s. They looked at some other aspects of the Texas real estate boom. They looked at some things that had gone on in Chile. They looked at a whole number of things. And what they saw was that that firms in many cases really had an incentive to loot. They basically had an incentive to make huge short-term profits and to take the money that people were lending them and invest it incredibly unwisely if they knew that those lenders would eventually be backstopped by the government. And if you go back and you read this paper now, I mean, it's 16 years old. If you go back and read this paper now, it's eerily prescient. And so it's not so much that lots of bankers, I don't think, were sitting around saying, we're going to do this, everything's going to go bad, and then the government's going to back us up. But I do think they were very much, some of them probably did that, but I do think many, many of them were very much affected by the idea that for them there was no downside. The huge amounts of money they were making in the short term would not be taken away from them in the long term if everything went bad.
Thomas, you cite the legalization of usury as one of the main causes of our current economic woes. For our listeners who aren't familiar with the concept, or I guess who haven't read the Bible, what is usury?
Well, up until the Reagan era, we had laws against usury in all of the states.
And actually, you say laws against...
They were interest rate caps of one kind or another. I'd say the simplest, most graphic way of describing it is to look at the early 21st century in the 1990s as a kind of a dystopian version of Frank Capra's It's a Wonderful Life. If you remember the movie, Mr. Potter is the bad guy who doesn't make the loans and the people need them, and George Bailey is the good guy who's making the loans because he's got good moral character and so forth. If this movie were run today, Mr. Potter would be making the loans like crazy, or at least up until the recent meltdown, handing out credit cards to pre-teenagers, whereas George Bailey would be saying, hold it. You know, so why did that change? It changed because there's no interest rate cap. I mean, Mr. Potter probably had to give out loans at 5 to 6%, and he wanted good moral character. He wanted the loan to be repaid. But when you lift off the caps on these interest rates, it doesn't matter if the loan is repaid. And this created a kind of addiction in the financial sector to very, very, very high returns. And the financial sector began to look better and better as a place for investment opportunities for capital compared to the manufacturing sector, which...
And we'll get into that later. But you write that laws against usury had existed since the time of the Babylonian Empire to the end of Jimmy Carter's term. Now, what changed all of that? This is not something Jimmy Carter did or something that Ronald Reagan did, is it?
Well, the states, individual states, began allowing exceptions, especially the captive state of Delaware. And by the 1970s, most states were allowing out-of-state banks to charge whatever they like. And when a few states objected, the Supreme Court slapped down the attempt to put caps on out-of-state banks that were issuing credit cards at 36% in good, honest, morally upright places like Nebraska. And that was the end of any law against usury.
And wasn't William Brennan the most liberal of all the Supreme Court justices, the one who wrote that decision?
Oh, you know, as a labor lawyer, I have to tell you that Brennan is the author of all sorts of terrible decisions that have led to the increase in inequality, and yet he's celebrated as this great liberal hero, which of course he is. But I have a list of bad Brennan decisions that have changed this country. But that was certainly one of them. Yeah, the idea was that the National Banking Act of 1864 preempted all the state laws of 1979 that limited interest rate caps, and that the real author of the whole meltdown is none other than Abraham Lincoln and the Republican Congress of the Civil War. But, you know, it's kind of a stretch.
Now, David, was there an economic advantage to eliminating caps on interest rates 30 years ago? Is there anything positive that we can see in it, or was it just simply something that was in the spirit of the times, another of the laissez-faire economic reforms being advocated by Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher?
Well, I guess I think of these usury laws a little differently. I agree that there are ways in which we've got problems with interest rates being too high for segments of the population, and that we should be introducing both more regulation and more competition into these areas, so that low-income people in some neighborhoods, for example, don't have these terrible payday lenders and rent-to-own stores as their main access to capital. The idea behind lifting the caps was that, in part, it was to help out banks, and I think in part there is a history of credit being extended to people who in the past didn't have credit extended to them, and often it involves higher interest rates than previously existed, because people who didn't have credit extended to them are almost by definition higher risk, and so I think that in many cases it was done to help the banks. It was justified, sometimes fairly, sometimes not fairly, as introducing more of a real market into these things, saying, look, if people want to borrow at this interest rate and people want to lend at this interest rate, they should be able to do it. The place where I guess I would have a difference is, I think when you look at the sort of loans that have really gotten us into terrible trouble here, which are the mortgages people can't pay back, I just don't see very many of them having huge upfront interest rates. I think in many cases, actually, the problem was that they had artificially low interest rates. People were taking out mortgages they could never pay back. Sometimes they were duped into doing so because the mortgage rate for the first couple of years was zero, or it was 3%, and it would spike after those first few years.
Can I respond to that, David?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Tom.
I disagree strongly with you. I think that these low interest rates came at the end of a period where everybody was in debt, and they're almost like loss leaders. And this country became addicted to debt. You know, the people pile up mortgages they can't pay. What's the consequence of that? It's going to be huge credit card bills because people are cash poor. So they're going to the banks for the interest rates that are higher than ever. And the deregulation of usury was really a signal to the banking industry and finance that your fiduciary obligations did not matter anymore. This whole long-term repudiation of the notion of fiduciary duty, I believe, began when the banks were told that there were no limits on which they could prey upon people. The other aspect of this that I think is important to look at is, it's fine, I'm in favor of easy credit and all sorts of things, but this easy credit was developed in the country at the time that the labor unions collapsed and people couldn't get wage increases anymore. So what was the alternative to keep the American standard of living going up? There was this whole culture created of people borrowing money to consume so that we continued our propensity to consume in this country, which Galbraith deplored, not with wage increases, but with going out and borrowing. That was very destructive. It was kind of an opiate that let employers off the hook. They didn't have to give out wage increases because people had these credit cards, and the credit cards were at very high interest rates.
But wait, let's back up, because actually the credit cards come at low interest rates, but the problem for many people is if they're even slightly late with a payment, there's an automatic hike in the rate, and one day they may discover that even though they're paying off their bills, that they're now being charged 25-30% interest. And even though they started, they thought that they were starting at 9%.
Yeah, unheard of in history. I mean, you know, normal. If you look at all these usury statutes, the interest rates are 8%, 9%, and those were high rates compared to when it gone up.
Well, how high can they go now? I mean, can a bank actually charge me 100% interest? That would be almost impossible to get by me, wouldn't it?
Sure, it could. It depends on the state law involved, but a national bank could charge you any amount of interest it liked.
Now, Joe Biden...
And people are being pushed out of... Very nice, respectable people are being pushed out of the credit cards now, which are charging up to 35% in some cases, and into payday loans. I've got clients who are paying 400% interest on loans.
I agree with what a lot of Thomas is saying about labor unions and wages declining. But the reason why I don't put that much importance on the usury laws is twofold. One, these laws were repealed 30 years ago, and this great crisis we're having didn't happen in the early 80s. It's happening now. And so I think the notion that something that happened 30 years ago brought on the crisis we're having now, I find it raises my skepticism a little bit. And the second thing is, if you look at the loans that really started to go bad here, it wasn't the credit card loans in which people were paying 17%, 18%. It wasn't these loans where people were paying huge interest. It was in many cases these loans where people didn't yet have any interest to pay. And the fact is, they had no legitimate chance to pay for these houses they were buying, even with low interest. The problem was they were banking on this continued appreciation of home prices, and so were the banks, that they thought was going to go on forever. And once it stopped, they proved unable to refinance their mortgage, unable to sell their homes. They proved unable to pay their mortgage as well, even at these low teaser rates, and the mortgage stuff started coming undone. And so I don't mean that we should spend the whole show debating this issue, and I agree that the usury issue is a real one for a lot of people. I just don't see it as the original cause of what we're going through here.
Well, we don't have to debate it the whole show, David, but I'd like to put in one word in reply, which is that crises that like this can build up over a 30-year period of time, and one of the great signals of the deregulation of usury was the idea that returns in the financial sector were going to be very huge and potentially very huge. Now, what I think brought this on was that while people got this notion that it's in America where you make the big money in finance and not in manufacturing, you put the cheap money that's coming into finance and not into manufacturing, not only is that at least one of the causes of the structural trade deficit that has developed over time and persists with us, but it created this culture where people kept looking for big returns in the financial sector with no notion of fiduciary duty. When you took away that kind of law of banking and finance, which was the cap on usury, you created a new culture there. And by the time of the meltdown, the financial sector had run out of the kind of real big opportunities for the kill. I mean, these instruments were opaque, hard for people to understand, and partly because they disguised the fact that there was no real there, that there was this continued addiction disclaiming a fiduciary responsibility, looking for the kind of returns that they had started to get used to, in part because of the deregulation of usury. And we just ran out of things to invest in the financial sector. We put on these spurious products, which turned out to be, you know, nothing. And that, I think, is not the exclusive explanation of what happened.
Well,
the cause in there.
And we're going to take a little break here, and we'll come back to this, maybe debate on some other issues as well, as we continue this conversation with Thomas Gagan, who is a labor lawyer and the author of an article called Infinite Debt in the April issue of Harper's Magazine, and with New York Times economic scene columnist David Leonhardt. A recent article of his was headlined, "The Looting of America's Coffers." Stay with us. We're back with New York Times economic scene columnist David Leonhardt and with Thomas Gagan, a labor lawyer whose article Infinite Debt is in the April issue of Harper's Magazine. I'd like to play a clip of Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke speaking to 60 Minutes correspondent Scott Paley on Sunday about how he thinks banks should be behaving right now.
I'd say that their job right now is to find a way to make loans to creditworthy borrowers, to get their banks back on the path of making good loans, safe loans, and to have a reasonable sense of humility based on, you know, what's happened in the last 18 months.
David, in order to do the things that Chairman Bernanke is talking about, things like making good and safe loans to creditworthy borrowers and having a reasonable sense of humility, wouldn't banks have to make a 180-degree turn from how they've been operating recently?
This is one of these really funny situations in which there are all these things that seem as if they're contradictory right now, right? We spent too much money during the boom and bubble, and so that's what landed us in these problems. But now we shouldn't save too much because that'll make the recession worse. And banks lent too much money in the past, which is part of our problems, but now we really need them to lend more. And so it's hard to figure out, is it a 180 or a 360 or is it a 720? It's a little bit difficult to keep track of.
Well, do you think he's being realistic there?
I think he's being realistic. I think that both the Fed and the Obama administration and the Bush administration before it have been relying a little bit too much on the bully pulpit, and I think, and not enough on really doing more to take control of these institutions. I don't yet know whether nationalization for these big institutions is the only option. I've heard pretty good arguments on both sides, but I do think they need to take a step toward nationalization, which is to say take more control of these companies. And this AIG scandal is just a great example of it, because the government is in this strange situation of owning 80% of the company, yet still being a little bit hands-off in how it's run. And it was too late to do anything about it, it seems, by the time we got to this weekend. But it certainly wasn't too late to do anything about it before. And yet the government was just a little bit too hands-off, given how much of a stake it now has. And so,
But weren't they being hands-off because of all of the criticism they'd been receiving? I mean, there are people on radio right now who are calling Barack Obama a socialist. And he is, he is to the left of George Bush, but he is to the right of many people in his own party.
Yeah, and I think they just need to sort of plow through that criticism. I mean, the notion that George W. Bush or Barack Obama or Ben Bernanke, that any of them is a socialist because of they're doing these bailouts is just not consistent with reality. This is what capitalist economies do when there are breakdowns. And the key is to get things functioning again and to then set up some rules so that it makes it less likely that the government has to buy banks as often as they are doing right now. And so, yes, that criticism's out there. And I agree that it is affecting the politics of this. But it shouldn't affect really how they manage these banks. And they've got to get these banks back on their feet and simply asking them to do right, as Ben Bernanke was doing in that clip. And to some extent, as the president did yesterday, probably isn't going to get it done.
Thomas, an implication in the Bernanke statement is that the banks have been making unreasonable and unsafe loans.
Well, I think that the banks ought to be making efforts to make people creditworthy again, and that's where the government should be forcing, creating a situation where people are creditworthy. That means forcing the banks to rewrite the mortgages and write down some of the consumer debt that has been paid back, the principal of which has been paid back, and a reasonable rate of interest has been paid back, and yet consumers still owe more. That's one of the ways of it's not just a matter of forcing the banks to extend credit, which a lot of people are focused on at the moment, but of making people creditworthy again.
I had a weird experience myself. I moved a couple of times recently, and in the process, bills didn't get to me as soon as they should have, even though I gave them the change of address. As a result, I paid off all of my credit card bills and discovered that I have now I'm at a rate of 28.9 with a zero, you know, with zero money owed. I called the bank, that was Bank of America, and they said, well, that's just the way it is, you were late. And the computer says that we have to charge you that. And I said, but I don't owe you anything. It isn't exactly like I'm a deadbeat. And they said that the guy was kind of sympathetic and said there's nothing that they could do about it. That's the way it is. Well, my response, of course, is to close down that account. But it seems to me that this really is a matter of usury, and usury in an odd situation because I don't owe them any money.
Sure. Well, hidden fees are a form of usury, too, right now. And that's
if you take a cash advance on a credit card, you're paying a lot of hidden fees as well. And a friend of mine got hit with a whole bunch of fees and was told, well, it was in that piece of paper that you signed. He said, oh, that thing with the five-point type? They said, yes, that one.
Yeah, it seems to me part of the way we're responding to this crisis is people have too much debt right now. This is one of the reasons that people are cutting back, and we're supposedly going to get out of this mess by piling on a lot of public debt. And that will get the economy going, and somehow people will work their way out of the private debt. You know, I think a much more direct approach is appropriate, and that we should have public guardians on these bank boards and be looking at ways of renegotiating the finance of mortgage loans. And there are bills that are trying to get their way through the Congress. They may never get through the Senate because of the 60-vote hurdle you know, have more cram-down type approaches, forcing renegotiation of mortgages. I mean, Dean Baker, I think, has this proposal about letting people stay in their homes as renters and as a way of forcing the renegotiation of mortgages. And I think we ought to be looking at ways of canceling some of this consumer debt, which is, you know, I'm about to file a suit for somebody who's paid, and I don't have the numbers right here before me, it's already paid well over $1,500 for a $700 loan. You know, it's not that he's typical. That's in a kind of an extreme case. There are others more extreme, but there are plenty of people like that who've been paying way too much interest on these loans, and the banks have profited too much. Write down some of this debt.
My guests are Thomas Gagin and also David Leonhardt, and we're talking about the current situation with the banks. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. David, you mentioned earlier the payday loans that that Thomas has also decried here, which can lead to 700% interest.
Yeah.
How come there's been no regulation on that? Does this fall into the same thing? That lawsuit that Thomas Brennan decided over 30 years ago?
Thomas may know more about the specifics on it.
I mean, William Brennan,
so
I'm sorry.
Talk about that, but I do think that it is part of this broader culture of non-regulation that we've had. And I think it's important to distinguish between non-regulation and deregulation. In many cases, it's not that we got rid of the regulations on the books that would have prevented some of these things. In many cases, those regulations are still there. I mean, Bernie Madoff is the classic example, right? No one passed a law saying that what he did was legal. However, we've had in Washington now for a long time huge regulatory agencies who have been run by people who have said that there are great dangers in overregulation. Alan Greenspan is the most obvious of those sorts of regulators. And there are dangers in overregulation, but there are also huge dangers in underregulation. And And we're now seeing those dangers of underregulation. And so I think one thing that we have to hope comes out of this is a little bit more of a focus on the dangers of underregulation, because when you have these bureaucracies filled with hundreds of people whose job it is to regulate, and they hear their bosses, political appointees out there talking about the evils of regulation, you have to assume that it makes them less likely to want to go out and pursue a case against a payday lender or a Bernie Madoff or you name it.
And many of the people who work in the regulatory agencies and the Treasury Department are from the banking industry, aren't they?
That's right, and then they go right back to it. I mean, the revolving door between them is really quite alarming, because you get a sense that what they're being hired for, often at very good salaries, is the knowledge that they have in how to avoid many of the effects of these regulations.
Thomas, the government has huge stakes in the banks now. Why isn't it pressuring them to reduce their fees and charges?
Well, that's a pretty good question. I think a lot of people are asking it and would like to see the government become much more proactive. Being a labor lawyer, I'm really quite fond of co-determination models where employees can sit on the boards. I think in this case, it's at least appropriate for the government to have its own directors on the boards. There's nothing like being in the room watching private self-interested people talk about
you say that
derivatives and other complex instruments. They wouldn't be doing that if they thought that they were being watched. You know, there's a great argument for just having public guardians in, or at least directors appointed by the government who are in the room watching. The problem is that we're likely to appoint the kind of people who are cut the deals in the first place, because, you know, look at Goldman Sachs' role in the Obama administration. One aspect of this that I just don't think is mentioned enough is the degree to which even the progressive movement in this country is led by, financed by, helped along by all sorts of liberal, progressive, Ivy League types who are working the financial sector. You know, so it's a little hard for them to see this whole culture as dysfunctional because they're part of it. And that is kind of one of the things that has paralyzed the Obama administration from going about and doing these things, I think. You know, they turn around, and they're wonderful, decent people there. I'm not trying to disparage anyone in particular, but it's just much harder to turn around and for an Obama administration, which raised so much money from the financial sector, which has draws upon the Harvards and Yales and Princetons, where, you know, a third of the graduating class goes directly into the financial sector, to turn around and be tough with it.
David, how much of is the all of this dependent on bad borrowers?
A fair amount.
So did they? Do you think that there was a cynical approach in some cases, look for people who were bad borrowers? Or be easier in giving money to people who are bad borrowers because you knew ultimately you were going to wind up being able to rack up interest rates, and the worst that would happen is that you would wind up repossessing the thing that they were borrowing for?
Well, I think in many cases the people making these loans, their incentives were simply to make the loan. So they were getting service fees in order to make the loan, and then they were repackaging it, and they were putting into all these things that none of us had ever heard of until they all went bad, like CDOs and MBSs. And so I don't even think they were thinking about, oh, I'm going to make this loan, and then I won't get any money up front because it's low interest rate, but then the interest rate will soar, and I'll make all this money. I think they were simply thinking about, I make this loan, and I make a profit. And then they were repackaging it and selling it to someone else. And because of the huge amount of money that was coming into this country looking for returns, as Thomas mentioned earlier, they had to reach out to bad borrowers. There really weren't enough good borrowers left. And in some cases, these bad borrowers were duped into taking out these loans. And in some cases, they either did understand or should have understood that they couldn't pay back these mortgages. I remember interviewing someone. I went to a mortgage broker, and I said, I'd like to talk to someone who has an adjustable rate mortgage. And then he put me in touch with a borrower. And then I called the borrower and started talking about the mortgage. And the borrower said, oh, no, I don't have an adjustable rate mortgage. And I called the mortgage broker back. And the mortgage broker sheepishly said to me, yes, that is an adjustable rate mortgage. I explained it. They just didn't listen. Now, I have no idea who was right, the broker or the person. But there were all sorts of people taking out loans that they didn't worry about whether they could make the payments because they figured their house price would go up, and so it didn't matter. And so I think most of the fault here certainly lies with the banks. Probably second would be the regulators who looked the other way. But I think third are the mass of people who took out loans that they couldn't actually afford.
Can I add a footnote to that?
Yes, and then we have to end it, unfortunately. Go ahead, Thomas.
One thing that facilitated this was that the legal rules got changed for getting the money back. So that, you know, in the old days, if you had a debt and it defaulted, you know, and I was representing you, you'd have to bring somebody into court and they'd testify and say, well, so-and-so took out the loan and such and such. Now people sign these arbitration agreements. The arbitrations are done over the phone. They're almost default to begin with, and you can present them in any court in the country. And it's really, really, really easy to go after people across the country. So, you know, as I said at the start of this Harper's article, that the Tribune said that a year ago in 2007 there were 130,000 collection cases pending in circuit court. I can't get a number at the moment, but that was even before the meltdown. That had been double from 2000. And if you throw in the mortgage foreclosure cases and other, which these aren't, the number, I'd extrapolate a reasonable figure somewhere of a quarter million, or more, collection or debt-related cases that are pending now in the circuit court of Cook County. I think that's a conservative estimate. Now, it's a big county, but that's one county. And at these sort of rates, you know, if this had kept going, I mean, every man, woman, and child would be in court, you know, in about 20 years in this country, just on a regular basis. And they do pull money out of people in these collection cases. Not always. They get a lot back. So that also, you know, is part of the change in the legal machinery. It's not just deregulation of usury or any one thing, but there's a whole series of changes that, you know, make it easier or facilitate creditors lending money to bad borrowers and getting the money back and processing it. It's a nefarious system.
And we have to leave it there, unfortunately. Thomas Gagin's article, Infinite Debt, How Unlimited Interest Rates Destroy the Economy, is the lead article in the current Harper's Magazine. Thank you so much for being with us, Thomas, again. And also, we've been talking with New York Times economic scene columnist David Leonhardt. Thank you both.
Thank you, Len.
Thank you. Yeah.